This is Transformational Pediatrics with Children's Mercy Kansas City. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Wilner. I invite you to listen in as we discuss three surprising lessons from the genomic revolution in pediatrics. My guest today is Dr. John Lantos, Director of Pediatric Bioethics at Children's Mercy Kansas City. Welcome, Dr. Lantos.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Dr. Lantos, thanks for joining me on this podcast. Before we make a deep dive into the genomic revolution, could you tell me a little bit about your background in this area and what you do every day?
Sure. So I'm a general pediatrician by background and training. I'm not a geneticist, but I have did a postdoc in bioethics and have been working in the field of bioethics for the last 30 years. Got involved in genomics when Children's Mercy became one of four centers funded by the National Human Genome Research Institute, NHGRI, back in 2014 to start exploring the use of whole genome sequencing for both screening and also for diagnosis of newborns.
Okay, thanks for that. So let's start by defining this genomic revolution. What does that mean exactly?
So to my mind, the genomic revolution began with the Human Genome Project, the worldwide effort to sequence the human genome. That was a $3 billion project that took about 6 or 8 years and finished in 2003 with the first sequencing of a human genome. Since then, the cost of sequencing has dropped from $3 billion to under $1,000, and getting whole genome sequences on patients, children or adults, or even fetuses, is now technically feasible and affordable for many people. What that's led to is massive efforts to try to understand what those genome sequences mean, and that is what I mean by the genomic revolution.
So when we talk about the genome, is that all of our DNA? Is that what we're talking about?
That is all of the DNA. That's the genome. People also talk about the exome, which is just the genes, which make up really a pretty small percentage of the whole genome, even though there are 20,000 genes.
So the genes are what make my eyes blue and all the other traits. And what do the exomes do?
Exomes are the genes. The rest of the genome, the part that's not exomes, is something of a mystery still. People initially thought, and this is one of the surprising findings, that the rest of that DNA, all those other base pairs that make up the whole genome, but are not part of the whole exome, that is, are not genes, didn't do anything. We're now starting to realize that it probably has much more complicated functions.
All right, so back to the patient. When a patient comes in and someone orders molecular diagnostic testing, what's the purpose of that?
So people have proposed two purposes, broadly speaking. One is to make a diagnosis in a case where a patient has symptoms that are suspected to have a genetic cause, but nobody's been able to figure out exactly what that genetic cause was. Before the genomic revolution, doctors would make their best guess. I think this is Prader-Willi. I think this is Wolff-Hirschhorn disease. And they'd look for the specific genomic variant that was associated with that disease. It was a hit or miss thing. If you suspected something, ordered the specific test, and it was negative, you didn't know what it could be. With whole genomes, you look at the whole array of genes, and you don't have to suspect anything specifically. Once you see variants, you decide whether you think they are likely to be pathogenic.
So before, you'd go hunting for a specific gene, and if you found it, aha, okay, you were right. But if you didn't find it, you were back where you started from, and you had to go look for something else. But with the whole genome sequencing, you're going to look at the whole genome. And do we know what's normal and what's not normal when we look at this genome?
That's a great question. With the Human Genome Project, that was sequencing on what's been called the reference genome. But the reference genome is specific for the race and ethnicity of the people whose genome it was. And one of the things we've learned is that there are differences based on race and ethnicity, among other things. So what's normal for a Caucasian may not be normal for an Asian person or an African person.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the ethics. I'm a neurologist and I treat adults, and I know sometimes the question comes up with a patient with a Huntington's disease, for example, which is genetic. But this disease often doesn't present until later in life. So you might have the gene, but appear perfectly normal, but then you're going to develop the disease when you're 40 or 50 or 60. And so some people want to know, hey, do I have that gene? And some people don't want to know. So how do you even approach that?
So Huntington's is a great example of one of my three surprising lessons. When predictive testing for Huntington's first became available, there was a lot of concern that people who got the results and found out that they were going to develop the disease would be depressed or maybe even suicidal, that the psychological implications would be devastating. What we found in Huntington's, and now have found in multiple other studies, is that most people deal pretty well with predictive information, that the uncertainty of not knowing is as psychologically devastating or problematic as the certainty that comes with genomic testing. So whether it's testing for a late onset disease like Huntington's or looking for a diagnosis for a rare disease in childhood, most parents of children and most adults are relieved to get the information, even if it's positive.
Well, in medicine, it's hard to treat something until you give it a name. So that helps, right? It's like, okay, this is this syndrome. You can also stop looking for other things, right? So once you know what it is, then at least you have a handle on what you're dealing with.
So let me point out one of the things you said, which lead to one of my third surprising findings from the genomic revolution. Initially, people thought the goal of this sort of testing would be to find treatments, but your Huntington's example is a good one. Often, what we do is diagnose diseases for which there are no treatments, and that's particularly common in children, because children have many more rare diseases than adults do. And often they are diseases for which there are no current treatments.
Now, in my email box, I've been getting educational programs about the diagnosis for SMA, which seems to be one of those genetic disorders for which there is a treatment. So is this opening up sort of new treatment pathways?
So the development of treatments for SMA did not depend on the genomic revolution, although it is one of the diseases for which new and effective treatments have been developed and approved by the FDA. They're enormously expensive, but they are effective. For most diseases, though, and this was one of the surprising findings, the diagnosis of a disease like SMA, that is an autosomal recessive genetic disease, but one for which there's no treatment, the most likely clinical change has been to talk to parents about palliative care. And so one of the concerns that I have as a bioethicist about the genomic revolution is that it's going to lead to huge questions about which genetic conditions predicted by which genetic tests ethically justify a decision to withhold or withdraw life-sustaining treatment.
Okay, we're not going to solve that one today. That sounds like a challenge. So how reliable are these tests? Because it's really making a huge difference, right? Turn left, go this way, turn right. Is this a test you can have confidence in?
That is a great question. And the answer is not as much confidence as we thought. So the more we learn about genes, the more we learn about the range of uncertainty for any particular genomic variant. In the talk that I gave for Grand Rounds at Children's Mercy a couple weeks ago, with the same title as this podcast, I talked about a case of a 10-year-old who collapsed while playing soccer. And they did a whole genome sequence on her and found that she carried a gene associated with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. That's a well-known cause of sudden death, particularly in athletes. So the doctors recommended that her whole family get tested. Turned out her 16-year-old brother had the same genomic variant. They sent him to see a cardiologist, and his cardiac evaluation was completely normal. So for clinicians, the question is, what's going on there and what should we do about it? Is the genomic test a false positive? Is it a condition that's going to develop later in life than it did for his sister? Should he be restricted from sports? And at present, the answer is that for a lot of genetic variants, we just don't know.
Right. So in medical school, I remember learning about genotypes and phenotypes, right? And that your genotype is certainly going to influence your phenotype, but maybe later or more or less, that it doesn't tell the whole story. Is that correct?
Yeah. And in fact, there's a philosophy, if you will, that genetics does predict accurately what the phenotype is going to be like. But that's a form of genetic determinism that as we learn more about how genes work in the real world, and perhaps how all these other portions of the whole genome that are not exomes, how they influence the expression of genes, or what's been called the penetrance of genes, that is, how much the phenotypic manifestations that are expected from the genome actually manifest themselves in the phenotype. We're learning that there's tremendous variation. So sometimes the phenotype tells us how the genotype works and not the other way around.
So let's suppose we have this interview that we're doing now and we do it again in 5 years. What's going to be different?
So genome sequencing is clearly being used more and more. And as we use it more and more, we're learning a lot more about both its strengths, its value, as well as its weaknesses and our ignorance about how best to use it in clinical medicine. I think with increasing use, we'll learn more and we'll be better able to say when genome sequencing is indicated, and we'll know more about how to interpret the results.
Dr. Lantos, I want to thank you very much for being a guest on Transformational Pediatrics with Children's Mercy Kansas City.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Dr. Andrew Wilner. This has been Transformational Pediatrics with Children's Mercy Kansas City. To refer your patient or for more information, please visit childrensmercy.org to get connected with one of our providers. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast and all the other Children's Mercy podcasts. Thanks for listening.